is Heart and Stroke Awareness Month, MediClinic and Cape Talk stand against heart disease. Join the conversation with Pippa Hudson live from the MediClinic corporate office in Stellenbosch, only on Cape Talk.
Now, the rest of the show today is given over to your questions around heart health. So if you are wondering about something you've already heard today, or you want to query something you've been told by a friend or a doctor, or perhaps experienced yourself, now is your chance. Pick up your phone and give us a call on 021-446-0567. You can leave your question as a voice note on 072-567-1567 or send an SMS to 31567. It's always lovely to have Dr. Darren Green with us in the studio. Thanks for coming out to join us in Stellenbosch at our MediClinic studio.
Oh, what a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And while we chat, I know the MediClinic team are going to come in the background and actually do my blood pressure and cholesterol screenings.
Stunning.
I don't know what the blood pressure is going to be doing, because stress has a role to play an impact on blood pressure, doesn't it, Darren?
Yeah, stress and pain. So we mustn't inflict any pain on you.
I've been in high heels since 7 o'clock. Does that count?
We can blame it on the high heels. There we go.
Okay. Darren, all jokes aside, obviously it's a very serious topic, and it's one of the major killers in South Africa. Over 200 people every day in South Africa die of heart disease.
Indeed. And what people don't understand is, from our stats from 2016 already, we were having 5 heart attacks per hour in this country and 10 strokes per hour. So I don't know how many people have ever thought of it in that way. So that takes you to, if you take 24 hours, 240 plus. That was 2 years ago. It's already accelerated from that. I think we're closer to 300 at the moment, strokes per day.
300 strokes per day. That's scary. No wonder it's one of the leading causes of death here. A lot of people, I think, have the misperception that this is something that only happens to the elderly, Darren. But I think I'm right in having read somewhere that about half of those incidents are actually people under the age of 65.
100%. And what people don't understand is the comorbidities. In other words, the multifactorial role that lifestyle plays in heart disease. In other words, the things that we can do to prevent it are things that have now become more and more apparent due to research and so forth about moving and, you know, changing our lifestyles. But looking at the condition itself, we sit in a population in South Africa that is riddled with chronic lifestyle diseases, including things like hypertension. We've got the highest incidence of hypertension in people aged older than 15 years old in this country. And we know that we are also one of the most obese nations in the world, which is a great risk factor for cardiovascular disease, as well as for diabetes mellitus. So, you know, it's a multifactorial problem, and certainly good to put in the limelight that we can prevent so many of these unnecessary deaths.
Yeah. Melinda mentioned earlier that heart disease presents very differently in men versus women. It was something I was not aware of. Won't you talk us through what the differences are?
Yes, it can. Certainly. We highlighted some of these differences in our campaign last year from MediClinic's point of view. But interesting. So generally, people associate a heart attack with chest pain. Mm. And it doesn't always present with chest pain. There are certain populations that can present atypically, and those are the diabetics, and certainly in women. The type of symptoms they present with might just be something as simple as dizziness or epigastric discomfort. That means just over your tummy area, below your rib cage, just an uneasy feeling, you know, a nervous sensation. And they don't have typical pain. The traditional angina-like pain or crushing chest pain from an infarct is associated, obviously, with a more pressurized feeling on the chest, almost tearing, and then with radiation of that pain into the left arm or into the left jaw, associated with things like nausea and vomiting, etc. as well. So, you know, certainly a spectrum of how a heart attack can present, and the forerunner and the warning signs are maybe what we can get into. And listeners often want to know, how do I know I need to be checked out? So maybe we can chat about that too.
Let's do that. First, we're going to say hello to Terry, who's given us a call on 021-446-0567 from Durbanville. Terry, welcome to the show. Good afternoon.
Yeah, good afternoon, Pip, and good afternoon, Dr. Green. I wonder, I'm sorry on behalf of my wife. Now, my wife, she works overseas. She's a carer. She looks after elderly ladies. And my wife is 73, but she looks after people like 98 or 99. But she has this, she said to me, she has an increasing stiffness across her shoulders and neck. And then she has pin needles down her right arm when she does a little bit too much and when she overdoes it a bit. My wife is, as I said, 73. But she's in good shape physically, and she... I'm also over 70, but I also work every day as well.
Fantastic. Active. both of you quite active, obviously.
Yeah, I know. We're very active people. Yeah, we're going to go on for another, people that have been born from live 200 years? No, don't want to do that.
So, yeah, he mentions, obviously, a condition that's associated with pins and needles, or the right term is paresthesia, going down both arms. Also associated muscle tension and increased spasm in the neck and shoulder girdle area. Often, at the age of 73, you have a loss of what's called cervical lordosis, or curvature of the C-spine, due to degenerative changes of the facet joints and the vertebrae in the neck. That leading to then narrowed spaces between the vertebrae and the likelihood of developing the condition cervical spondylosis. And we can't diagnose on the phone, obviously, or on air, but certainly she would consider the cause being a nerve compression type of pain and a neck-related origin for the pain that she's experiencing with bilateral symptoms in the hands and arms. And I suggest that's where she should obviously look at some help. You know, when you the age of 73 and you're fit and active like she is, one, certainly she's a good 73. So her lifestyle in terms of mobility and all that's important. But preserving the spine starts at a very young age. And we preach and advocate people to actually look at how to educate yourself with good spinal health starting at a young age. And unfortunately, stilettos are not part of that package for long periods of time to the ladies, but certainly stabilizing your spine and looking at strengthening your core and spinous muscles, etc., are crucial in this process.
Okay, Terry, thanks so much for your call. Darren, let's talk about those crucial warning signs and when you need to get checked out.
Cardiovascular disease. You know, I think knowing the risk factors are right at the top. So smoking, there is proven a correlation between smoking and your increased risk of cardiovascular disease. Your diet is proven to have a massive effect, and so is the whole cholesterol debate that we have. Does cholesterol actually cause heart disease? Well, it's a lot more detail than that. Obviously, people ask, how does cholesterol cause heart disease? And you know, the pipes, basically, the tubes that lead or that bring blood, rather, to the heart muscle, when they become narrowed or blocked, there isn't enough oxygen that's delivered to the heart muscle, and that's why you develop the pain syndrome. And if that oxygen flow is not restored quickly enough, you could have irreparable or irreversible damage to the heart muscle. That's the term myocardial infarction. So what happens with cholesterol and plaques is the unstable plaques can basically, that have attached to the wall, can break off and actually cause obstruction. And depending on the hardness or softness of those plaques, they can even then disintegrate and move on and cause temporary obstruction. But if it's permanent and long enough, it could lead to dire consequences. Now, not everyone that has high cholesterol has plaques in their arteries. Well, yeah. Why is that not so? Well, for the cholesterol to actually stick inside those pipes, normally there needs to be a pre-runner of an inflammatory process. So pro-inflammatory things are even things like omega-6, for example. You'll do a lot of research on the omega-6 lipid storm, if you go and Google that, for example. Looking at that, looking at hypertension chronically and how that stretches the inner walls of the blood vessels, causing structural changes, and how then that facilitates the process of the lipids that are busy going past the artery to actually, like Velcro, stick to the inner lining of that wall. So you often need a pre-runner of inflammation on the inside of the walls to cause the disease, the cardiovascular disease in this case. So the risk factors that we've mentioned, be aware of them: smoking, obviously your diet, your cholesterol, your hypertension. These are things that cause structural changes in the cardiovascular system over time and put you at higher risk. And then the family history. If you know that your grandparents or your parents had heart attacks and needed stents or a bypass in their 40s, that's a young heart attack. That means that you might not have cholesterol causing it, but you might even have just really, really curly, whirly blood vessels with lots of narrowings, and that's obviously the coronary arteries.
Okay. We're talking heart health with Dr. Darren Green. And as we chat, I'm about to have my blood pressure checked. We're going to do a cholesterol check as well. And I don't know, we'll see how good or bad the results are. I guess we'll determine on whether I share them on air or not. But before we go to Sue, who's waiting to chat to us from Goodwood, lots of people asking about the role of stress. I mean, I can joke about what stress does to my blood pressure and my pulse while I'm on air. But talk to us about the role that stress plays in heart health.
So what happens to your body when you do undergo stress? Stress is not all bad. We often need stress to get going, to get moving, and to change being lazy and sedentary to actually get into action and perform. Chronic stress, however, is not good. It has an effect on your biology, on your psychology, and on your sociology to a degree where your physiology releases hormones like cortisol to cope with it. The effects of long-term cortisol being pumped out in your system over time can lead to very interesting medical consequences. I hope that wasn't sore, by the way, when they pricked
you. Didn't feel
good?
A thing, no. Hardly felt
wonderful,
it.
Wonderful. I was going to suggest a foot massage while they do your blood pressure.
I'm all for that. Absolutely no reason to disallow that idea. But just to explain what's happening in the background here is the pressure cuff is on my arm taking my blood pressure. I've had a little prick to get a drop of blood to check the cholesterol. And I'm really interested to see the results because I know that I'm a regular blood donor. And when I donate blood every 8 weeks, my blood pressure is religiously 120 over 80.
Oh, wow. Okay. Good.
Come hello, rain or shine or hell or high water. So I'm interested to see what it's telling. Are we ready to get a reading?
No.
Not yet. Okay. So in a minute or two, I'm really intrigued to see what the difference is like given the stress I'm under right now.
So the stress, I was saying, cortisol gets pumped out of your adrenal cortex, really responds to that. And the effect of chronic stress on your physiology affects the hormone cycles between the different systems. And so too, it affects then your appetite control, your sleeping control. So you develop symptoms like insomnia. You develop symptoms like eating too much or eating too little to compensate for the overflow of the stress. And that then has dire consequences on your health and your general well-being.
Right. Now, while I get my results, we're going to say hello to Sue, who's been waiting very patiently on the line from Goodwood. And Sue, I believe, is a heart patient who is going in for surgery quite soon. Sue, good luck to you. Thank you so much for your call today. Mm-hmm.
Hi, can I speak to the doctor?
Go for it.
You are the doctor, Sue?
Yes. On Friday, I'm going for a, they're going to explain to me what they're going to do to me. I'm going for a valve replacement. I think it's the aorta or something like that. But all my arteries and that, everything is fine because I've gone for all those tests as well.
Good.
Yes. What's your question, Sue? Are you just wanting some reassurance about the procedure?
Yes. They're going to explain it to me on Friday. I just want to know what is the effect afterwards. Will I get a stroke? I'm scared I get a stroke or something like that.
Oh, shame, Sue. Thanks for calling.
Obviously, a worrying position to be in, and I'm glad you've reached out and asked for some reassurance. What can you tell, Sue, Darren?
Yeah, so I think she mentioned the aorta valve. The aorta being one of the largest oxygen-rich or arteries, obviously, that leave the heart, responsible for transporting oxygenated blood from the heart to the rest of the body. There's a valve, obviously, as the blood exits the heart between the chamber of the heart and the aorta. And the aortic valve is very important, you can imagine. It's got to generate a certain amount of pressure, and before that valve actually opens and releases, a certain amount of pressure behind it needs to be generated, and the heart needs to then go into systole, and when it relaxes, obviously into diastole. But that process and synchronicity is very, very tightly coordinated, and the heart valve, if it leaks, can cause health consequences, like things of the red blood cells being broken down or lysed, as we call it. Or it can also lead to things with blood pressure and long-term cardiovascular risk. So in this case, the heart valve operation it's an important one and a big one. Obviously, you're seeing a skilled cardiothoracic surgeon that's going to be involved and a cardiology team that's going to be looking after you. And I think the preparation for your op is very important. So you'll know the rules about when, if you are on any blood thinners, when to stop taking them. So know if you're on Ecotrin or aspirin or even heparin, you need to know when to stop taking them so that your blood viscosity, the thinness of your blood, so to say, is perfect at the time when you have the surgery, that you don't bleed excessively, etc. Along with that, the risks, obviously, with every procedure are anesthetic risks.
Yeah.
And then things like infection and your care afterwards. So it's a big up, and we can just say good luck. But your bit in terms of controlling what you can is being compliant, listening to the preoperative instructions very well, and then behaving yourself once you've had the op to ensure the quickest possible recovery. But Godspeed, all the best.
Sue, our very best wishes go with you on Friday. Thank you so much for your call. Right, my numbers are in, Darren, and interestingly, my blood pressure is higher than I would normally. It's normally 120 over 80. It's right now 132 over 85. What does that actually mean?
It means that you need to visit the loo. I think you're just knaping it in. I think that's the cause of your high blood pressure. I promise you, we'll take it just now, and we'll see it'll be down.
It'll be down again. Yep. And my cholesterol's 3.95. I got a thumbs up from the nurse on that one. Okay, so that's good news. the point of doing this on air is not that I want everybody to know my ins and outs and medical habits, but to show that it's a really unobtrusive test and very simple. I've done it while conducting a conversation, while reading SMSs, taking phone calls and checking tweets. It's very, very short and quick. It's not painful at all. So if you have any hesitation about going to have these tests done, it really is as simple as a finger prick and a little bit of a squeeze on the arm.
That's it.
And it's done and dusted in a couple of minutes.
And it can screen you to have it checked again. It doesn't mean that you've got high blood pressure after one reading, by the way, because a lot of people start stressing when they have the armband around them and they in a pressurized situation with everyone watching, firstly. So just remember, to diagnose hypertension accurately, you need two separate readings in relaxed circumstances. And even if we're doubting the diagnosis, we even send you home with what's called an ambulatory blood pressure monitor, which can take your blood pressure even while you're sleeping at night. And that's a much more accurate way of getting readings over time.
Okay.
And then we can act on it. So, yeah, but well done for being proactive. Fantastic.
Thanks. Okay. Really interesting SMS in from Nicola here, who says, I had a hypertension emergency 4 years ago at the age of 41. Collapsed in an aerobics class. Ended up in ICU with a blood pressure of 270 over 190. My physician is still puzzled as to what caused it. Her question is, why did I not have a stroke or a heart attack with such an astronomically high blood pressure? I was fit and healthy at the time, and I still am, despite now taking blood pressure medication daily. I've never heard of a blood pressure that high in my life.
We do. Just because I work in an emergency unit, obviously, we do see blood pressures in surplus of 200 systolic, over 150 diastolic. Sure. You know, a hypertensive emergency is often accompanied with the blood vessels in the eye that can rupture, and you often get what's called a subhyaloid bleed in the eye when you examine the eye and do fundoscopy. But understanding blood pressure. So why doesn't everyone with high blood pressure pop an artery and have a stroke? Well, it's simple. As you get older, the walls of the blood vessels, they get harder. They hyalinize. In other words, pathologically, what happens is they typically develop systolic hypertension as you get older in older people. And that's because the blood vessel structure changes with time. The ability of your blood body to control the diameter of the blood vessel and regulate pressure also changes. So if you had a weakness in any of the blood vessels, like an aneurysm or a dissection, accompanying with blood pressure that goes up, you can imagine there's a small little tear in the inner layer of the tube or the pipe, and then the pressure builds up. It's like a balloon. If there's a thin area and you put up the pressure, it's going to pop right at
that
spot.
In that scenario, yeah.
So you're just very fortunate, I think, that you didn't have any aneurysm that wasn't diagnosed or a dissection that was lurking, and we're so grateful. But, there are things that can cause hypertensive crises, from hormone conditions that are associated with adrenal gland, like pheochromocytoma. That's an adrenal gland tumor. Basically, that often if you don't find other causes for the hypertension, that's one of the things we can test for in the blood. And I'm sure they did a thorough check of your kidneys and your brain and your cardiovascular system with that. And now they're monitoring you immaculately.
And well done that you've been compliant with the medication. And Nicola, I'm so glad you came through it. Okay, thanks for your SMS. Anonymous asking, can stress lead to raised cholesterol levels?
Yeah, so stress, it certainly can. Why? And why does it do that? Well, the absorption of things like fat, for example, are controlled by your thyroid hormone driving the metabolic tempo quite often. And obviously, that's also because you have to generate central body heat. And the thyroid hormone is very important for doing that. So your metabolic tempo is certainly affected by stress. What do? When we stress? We eat more, or we don't eat at all, which in turn has an effect on our insulin secretion, which in turn has an effect on the amount of our regulation of our blood sugar levels. So the link between stress and cholesterol certainly can be there due to habituation, but not only that, because of the complexity of how one hormone affects the next plays a massive role. And habits around stress obviously lead to obesity often. If you think about it,
so eating too much,
there's association with some of the mental disorders, eating too much. Some people go the opposite way, where they end up eating nothing and going on hunger strikes, where they just lose weight, which is also not healthy. So, you have to associate both of those.
Okay. We're chatting heart health with Dr. Darren Green. I'm happy to take a couple more calls on 021-446-0567. You can also do what B has done and send an SMS to 31567, wondering whether pain in the middle of the leg could be related to a stroke.
So, the pain associated with stroke is normally nerve pain. Pain in terms of the leg, you know, which part of the leg is the upper leg, the lower leg, the calf, etc. Is it worse when you touch it? Is it an electric-like pain that's a nerve-like pain, burning sensation? Or is it like something stabbing you with a knife? Or, you know, we need a lot more detail to help her in terms of direction, in terms of the leg, I'm afraid.
Okay. Sorry, B. Let's move on. Several people asking about the side effects of statins and whether there is anything you can take to reduce those side effects.
Yes. I think firstly, with all medication and all medicine and pharma and all this, people must really ask themselves, firstly, is pharma the only solution to what I'm taking medication for? And I think being compliant and listening to your practitioner in terms of the benefit-risk ratio, that's the discussion you need to have. Is me taking the statin for my cardiovascular risk profile and my cholesterol issues, is it essential? What's the evidence for people in my age group with my risk factor profile in it preventing? How many people do you need to treat to prevent one heart attack by taking a statin? Those are the questions and the conversations you need to be having with your GP, not just your specialist and your cardiologist. So you need to open up that. So what I want to say to people is obviously there are familial syndromes of cholesterol and dyslipidemias where no matter how immaculately you eat, you might still have a high risk profile due to triglycerides being high, etc. And the risk of diabetes is even higher than cardiovascular disease in that case, where the diabetes actually is the accelerator of the cardiovascular disease and not just purely the triglyceridemia, for example. So often the sugar control issues, and that's been obviously in the limelight a lot in the past 2 years, the effect that sugar has on causing inflammation of the blood vessels of the heart as a pre-runner to cardiovascular disease. And that's quite exciting. So at least we know about that now. So, yeah. There you go.
So if you are taking them and you're experiencing side effects, is there anything you can do to minimize those?
Well, I think
those?
You need to know what they are first. And if you read those package inserts, then you really get paranoid because there's a list of like 50 different things. And you often think it's that. So I think if you are experiencing something, talk to the person who prescribed it to you first. Ask them, could it be that? Is it a dose responsive thing? In other words, is it because I've gone on to a double dose of the medication I'm taking? If I reduce it, does the symptom go away? And then obviously you can take it from there.
Thanks, Darren. Let's go back to the lines and say good afternoon to Jill in Glencairn. Nice to have you with us, Jill.
Hi, good afternoon. Pippa, I would just like to ask the doctor, I came in on the tail end or for the middle of the conversation. If my dad suffered with cardiovascular disease and died of a massive heart attack after having a number of stents. And a few years ago, I had a total thyroidectomy. And they seem to be battling to get my thyroid levels stable. I experienced still major hot flushes and all sorts of funny, you know, symptoms. I just would like to know, what is there an increased risk factor with that kind of family profile?
Good. So regarding the family cardiovascular disease, it would depend, firstly, if your dad's cardiac history and events started at a young age or not. If he had his stents and his first presentations of ischemic heart disease in his 40s or whether he was 70, that's important to differentiate. Either way, secondly, what were his other risk factors? You know, was he a smoker? Did he have high blood pressure and cholesterol issues as well? For yourself, obviously, the age that you're at after having a thyroidectomy, you must remember to normalize thyroid levels. It's trial and error, and it takes time. There's so many things that influence the absorption of even the medication you're taking of the synthetic thyroid hormone, your Altroxin, for example, that you're taking. And you need to understand that your liver's absorption of these medications also can change with time. So getting the level right requires good compliance and rigorous follow-up. But the symptoms, some people have normal thyroid levels on a spectrum, but on the lower end of normal, they might not clinically feel the same as someone that has a normal range that's slightly higher. In other words, some people are more sensitive to fluctuations within the normal range of these of treating these conditions. And that will mean that you'll need to have a good relationship with your physician to discuss those symptoms.
Thanks for your call, Jill. We're going to squeeze in one last quick question on the SMS line that several people have asked about. What is a TIA, or a mini stroke as it's been called?
So it stands for transient ischemic attack, and a transient means that it's going to end And that's just the thing about it. It is regarded as a warning or mini stroke because the symptoms generally clear up completely within 24 hours. So you can look like you've had a stroke depending on which artery is blocked. Obviously, if it's the left side of the brain or right side of the brain, you might present with weakness, slurred speech of the face, arm, or leg. You might stutter and struggle with word-finding difficulty or sensory loss, etc. Or even think something as simple as eye movements, you know. But they clear up within within a certain time period. And in this case, as I said, the condition is totally gone the next day. Why it's important. The highest risk of developing a full-on heavy serious stroke is within 13 days of the TIA. So just leaving a TIA is not the answer. You need to have it checked out properly. You need to have your heart assessed with an ECG looking for an atrial fibrillation or an irregular heart beat or rhythm. You need to have the risk factors addressed, like your hypertension. You might have to be put on aspirin, like the professor spoke to us a little bit earlier. And then have sonars or Dopplers done, which is a sonar that looks at the blood vessels in your neck, carotid Dopplers, to look at whether there are any narrowing or plaques. The most common cause of a TIA are cholesterol plaques or atheromatous plaques that break off in the neck, travel up to the brain, and then block one of the blood vessels, and then they, because the plaque might be soft, disintegrates
and
then you have restored blood flow to that area and the symptoms improve. And that's how a TIA works.
So once again, don't ignore the symptoms if you see them.
Correct.
That is where we must wrap things up, Darren. Always great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us at this special outside broadcast from Mediclinic Corporate in Stellenbosch today.
Thank you.
The message is, be heartwise this month. Go and get those basic health checks done. Check out the Mediclinic website and find out where you can have them done for free during the month of September.